Welcome to Found at TU, a monthly podcast where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research, how they do it, why they love it, and what they are finding out. I'm Jolie Jensen, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa, and today we're here with Dr. Jeff Alderman, Associate Professor of Community Medicine and Director of TU's Institute for Healthcare Delivery Services. Welcome to Found at TU, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Jolie.
Well, we always begin the same way, which is to ask our guests to say in one simple sentence what they study.
Sure. Well, I'm a physician, but I'm also an academic. And really, I look at ways to improve the healthcare system. And my interest is the intersection between health policy and end-of-life care.
So how did you get interested in end-of-life care?
Well, I've been a palliative medicine physician for 16 years now.
Can I stop you right there?
Yeah.
What does palliative medicine mean?
So palliative medicine is the branch of medicine that really takes care of folks with serious illness, and it focuses on alleviating suffering. And suffering might be physical suffering, like breathlessness or pain or nausea, or it might be more social or emotional suffering, like anxiety or depression or isolation. And many people with serious illness have what's called spiritual suffering, where they feel a sense of disconnectedness from the universe, from their faith. So palliative medicine is really about relief of suffering in multiple domains, physical, emotional, social, and spiritual.
And so palliative medicine is a branch of traditional or mainstream medicine. I would think most doctors would say, I alleviate suffering.
Sure.
I'm betting that you're talking about suffering in a much broader and deeper way, right?
Sure. When you go to medical school, you have this idea that you're going to help make people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, that's true. But what I found was in my practice before I was a palliative medicine doctor, I was doing a lot of ordering of tests, checking of boxes, and not really in tune with what my patients wanted most. So when the opportunity came up to study further, I decided I wanted to practice this emerging field of palliative medicine, which is part of mainstream medicine. And I wanted to focus on people with serious illness, people that may be at the end of life or just may have one, two, or seven diseases all at the same time.
Oh.
I felt like they were the people that always seemed shortchanged by the system. They weren't getting what they needed, and they always felt terrible. And I wanted to get back to finding ways to make them feel better.
And it sounds like to address their true needs, not just the diagnostic needs, but these other kinds of needs that were causing them suffering.
Absolutely. When someone is suffering with physical symptoms, it's true. You need to focus on alleviating pain or restlessness or insomnia because it's hard to function when you're physically suffering. But when you get people back to their baseline, when they are no longer physically suffering, there's a tremendous amount of emotional, social, and spiritual suffering that's associated with illness. We don't think about taking care of that in traditional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
We leave that to someone else. The problem is often there is no one else.
And this is product of modernity, right? I mean, it used to be that you were cared for by relatives in your home who would address these multiple ways. But part of this is the hospitalization, right? That most people with serious illness are in a hospital setting treated by professionals, not necessarily having this range of suffering that you just described to us.
Exactly. Addressed. So you find that a number of folks with serious illness spend time almost in a ping pong game. They go between home, the hospital, maybe some kind of step-down facility like rehab or a long-term care facility or a skilled facility, and then something goes wrong in the night and they're back in the hospital, get treated, and then discharged somewhere else and back and forth and back and forth. And when you ask people, where would they want to be with serious illness, I've never heard anybody say they prefer to be in an institution. So really thinking about where are people best served. The problem is that for a number of folks with serious illness, they have symptoms that bother them so much that they need to come in and see one of us. And sometimes they can come to the office, but sometimes their symptoms are so urgent that they need to be seen someplace more acutely, like the hospital. And what palliative medicine does is it tries to match people's goals with treatment. So if you're telling me you want more than anything else not to be in the hospital anymore, let's focus on that and alleviate your pain, your breathlessness, and your restlessness at home.
Ah, and that was what you were encountering then. As you trained in palliative medicine, you were trained then in ways to alleviate those kinds of suffering. And what, help people go to home? But is this something that is being offered now? Or it sounds like you got at the beginning of an emerging field that is not changing perhaps as fast as we would have hoped. So can you talk a little bit more about what you're learning through your research and how that's helping?
Yeah, so a few things there. First of all, you have a number of people that require more advanced alleviation of symptoms than what traditional physicians can provide. Mm. So that's the advanced training in palliative medicine, advanced training in pain and symptom relief, for sure. But the other thing that palliative medicine also focuses on is honest conversation and restoring quality of life. So a lot of what we uncover after we relieve the bothersome physical symptoms like pain is to ask people, given the illnesses that they have, what is it that they want most? And for many people, what they want most is to have high quality of life. They don't want to suffer from burdensome symptoms. And at the same time, they want somebody to demonstrate that they care about them and that they'll be honest with them. In other words, patients and families, because patient and family together are considered a unit in palliative care, often have a lot of questions. Why has no one told me all of this information before? What am I going to expect given the fact that I'm diagnosed with these diseases? Do I have to be on these medicines forever? Does this mean I'm going to die? These are the common questions that somehow somebody else at some other stop in the delivery system never really answered. So a lot of what we do is we promote honest conversation. What I was finding was that when I was seeing patients, I was spending a lot of time apologizing, apologizing for the system, not for people, but the system didn't seem to pick up on what people's needs were. In other words, the system may have been able to provide a diagnosis. The system may have been able to prescribe a pill, but it didn't really address what people's true goals were. So much of palliative medicine is uncovering all of the events that have taken place previous to my visit and find out what are the most important things in someone's life? What makes them tick? What is it that they want, given everything that's happened? And as I said before, sometimes the most important thing is just, I need to be at home. I need to be with my children. Mm-hmm. I need to be with my spouse. I need to be with my books. I want to be in my garden. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the casino. That's what I do. Whatever that is, that's the most important thing to that person. And the entire plan of care should revolve around that one important thing. And what I felt was that the healthcare delivery system was really focused on one doctor, one patient, one prescription, and not taking into account those larger items, those larger goals, those values that were most important to that person. So I became very attracted to palliative care. But as you mentioned, you're correct that palliative medicine is only at the beginning in terms of having a foothold in American medicine. It's only been around for about 20, 25 years or so, and it often gets confused with hospice.
Ah. So what is the misunderstanding here about palliative care versus hospice?
So people usually say in the same sentence, palliative care, hospice, end of life, death, dying.
Ah.
It all gets lumped into one concept. And I think that's what I refer to as the either-or concept. In other words, we have this mentality sometimes among ourselves, like clinicians, providers, doctors, and within the patient world, that we have to do everything possible to keep somebody alive no matter what until we all agree this isn't worth it. This is low quality of life. This is futile. And then we literally throw people into an entirely different bucket where we go from doing everything to just keeping them comfortable. And that's hospice, palliative care, death and dying, end of life care. And that's a very faulty way of thinking. Better is to think about palliative care as basically any care that's delivered that improves quality of life, relieves suffering, and promotes honest conversation at any stage of serious illness. Palliative care could be used for people who have less serious illness, but honestly and truly, it was designed for people who have a chronic illness like heart disease or cancer or emphysema or diabetes or dementia, one or two or even nine of those illnesses altogether, compile a lot of the suffering that people have in America. So as a result, we get involved in people who have serious illness or serious illnesses to perform those services of uncovering people's goals of care, finding out what their values are, and relieving suffering.
Can I take you back to that comment you made about that you treat the family and the patient are a unit? Because I would think that this is a conversation, you know, none of us have faced this before often. This is a first time for many people. And we tend to use, I think, the medical profession as guides. And if their focus, if the traditional medicine's focus is on symptom, I mean, you know, addressing, curing or fixing, and you're suggesting an alternative that includes meaning and purpose and a value, does the family go along with this? Are they afraid of the, you know, the hospice mentality that you described? Or are they willing, can they understand the importance of honest conversation and focusing on meaning and value?
Patients and families are all over the map when they see us coming. A lot of the time, we have to define exactly why we've been called in. Sometimes they won't let us in the room. They'll say, don't say palliative.
Really?
We're afraid of that word. And we just have to educate and say, we're here to relieve suffering. And once we do that, let's talk about what next. We have to explain that even though we do take care of people at the end of life, there are plenty of people that require palliative care that have years and years left to live, but are suffering as a result of illness. And by explaining and re-explaining and re-explaining again exactly what we're here to do and why we're doing it, and that the family is a part of that team, the more acceptance we start to gain in having those conversations.
Something else that you said was that, you know, individuals are on board with this often, but the system itself is not designed to be supportive. Can you say more about that? I mean, because I do feel that, like, you know, all of us are part of systems that often make it impossible for us to be human or more difficult. And what you're describing sounds so wonderful and sensible, but our system doesn't seem to be designed for it at all.
Sure. And there are a lot of reasons behind that. We have a healthcare system that is largely fragmented. We have a system that does a poor job at communicating among different providers. So if you have someone with serious illness, chances are they have one, two, or seven different doctors or other non-physician therapists taking care of them. And there's a pretty high probability they're not talking to one another.
Yeah.
So a lot of what happens is there's a lack of coordination of care. And this leads to confusion. This leads to a feeling of disenfranchisement among patients and their families from the health system. They get frustrated. They get scared. They get angry. So part of why we do what we do is to help bridge together some of the fragmentation that has taken place. And I think because regular everyday medicine is based on encounters and technology and procedures, it hasn't learned yet to accommodate this idea of rewarding coordination of care, of having conversations with people, getting into their ideas about what's most important to them. There's just hasn't been traditionally a good way to figure out how to code for and reimburse for that kind of care.
Well, that moves us to the question of finances. Can you say more about the costs now of the normal way of doing things and how palliative care can influence that?
Sure. This is the epicenter of my research and finding better ways to not only get palliative medicine further along within the universe of providing care to people, but how do we pay for it? And one payment system we do have in place is the hospice Medicare benefit. And what that does essentially is it pays for all care for people who are in the last 6 months of life. This is a Medicare benefit. If you have Medicare, the federal government pays for your care and it's completely contained. It's a very nice benefit, but you have to be terminally ill. Let's think about people that do have one, two, or seven serious illnesses all at once, but I can't say that they're going to die in the next 6 months. Well, how do we take care of these people? The only way that exists right now is to expect folks to get in the car, drive to their primary care or specialist clinic. They have to get upstairs or wherever they're going into that clinic, sit in a waiting room, wait to be called, put onto an examining table, et cetera. It doesn't work very well. So a better option is to design a Medicare hospice benefit for people who are not terminally ill but have trouble leaving home.
Yeah.
Maybe they're caring for an elderly spouse of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe their mobility is limited because of pain or disability. But unfortunately, we have not come up with a payment system in America that values delivering home-based care and rewards when we are able to serve people's needs, match their goals, uphold their values, and keep them out of places like the hospital, the emergency department, et cetera, where they don't want to go.
And not only, as I understand it, do they not want to go there, but it's financially ruinous to the family for years to come. Can you talk a little bit more about how end of life, what we're doing wrong? Can you just say a little bit more about that?
So one of the things that we tend to do in healthcare is provide a lot of care all at once to people who are acutely sick. We call it rescue care. And one of the things we don't talk about in the midst of rescue care is how much is this all going to cost?
Mm-hmm.
I've even heard physicians, nurses, folks that work in the hospital, look, we're here to take care of your mom, your dad. We're not here to talk about cost. Don't worry about that. Well, we have to worry. As it turns out, medical debt is one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in America. And a shocking statistic to me is that when someone dies, a third of all families enter poverty.
What?
And the reason behind that is that not only have you lost the income of the person that died, but chances are that person had a series of illnesses over a prolonged period of time, and the spouse or other caregivers in that family basically didn't work for a period of time and ended up losing potential income while serving as caregivers. So it's not hard to realize that given the amount of medical cost that's incurred when someone is facing serious illness and then later dies, that it can really wipe out someone's savings. It can really throw people into all kinds of financial positions that are not only devastating, but were unexpected because no one had conversations up front about what this may cost. And what you find is that when you apply palliative care, and when you have honest conversation with people, patients, their families, about what to expect and what different options exist, you actually discover that a large number of people will decide, wait a minute, I don't want this procedure. I don't want this cardiac catheterization. I don't want this chemotherapy. I don't want this hospitalization. And they end up not receiving invasive, aggressive therapies. And not only do they feel better, they incur much less debt. And it turns out some of them may even live longer.
Really? Because?
There are a few studies now that have demonstrated that when you take people with metastatic lung cancer, heart failure, even emphysema, and you start applying palliative care and you keep people away from the hospital, from very invasive procedures, that it does something in terms of improving people's ability to connect with loved ones, connect with their lives. And as a result, some people actually live longer than if they did undergo the invasive, aggressive procedures that are often indicated for people who have such severe burden of illness.
Mm-hmm. And the quality of their life is obviously much better, too. It isn't just length, obviously, but how it's spent. That
quality
time is spent.
Demonstrated by ability to move, quality demonstrated by feeling good. And when you start looking at scales of depression, anxiety, they're often better.
You mentioned several times honest communication, and I know that it used to be traditional to not even tell the patient that they might have an illness, but now you're often, it seems to me, physicians are very clear about the illness and the symptoms and the treatment, but not about the realities of what it is to experience that treatment. I mean, tell me what you'd say in an honest conversation with someone to help them understand, and the family, you know, the options available to them.
One of the things that happens when we start a conversation is we ask the question, what have you been told about your illness? What have you been told about your wife's illness? What is your understanding of what's going on? And it's almost shocking how common the response is, we haven't been told anything, or no one seems to know what's going on. And I know that's not true. I know that in medicine, we spend a lot of time communicating with people, but sometimes it's like a game of telephone. People don't understand at the first go around, particularly when the news is bad. So if you mention the word cancer and you start talking about treatment and options and prognosis,
people have just shut down when they hear cancer, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you have to repeat the message, usually in a more controlled setting where you have time and you demonstrate that you care and that you are interested in people and what they want to know. It turns out that you're able to amplify people's understanding of what's going on if you can do it through some kind of family meeting or other controlled environment.
So what else do we need to talk about with your research? What haven't we covered?
So one of the things that I'm most interested in is the fact that you have a healthcare delivery system that, like I said before, is fragmented, poor communication abounds, people throughout the healthcare system live in silos. Here is an innovation, palliative care. It can be applied at any level of serious illness, whether someone has 5 minutes or 5 years left to live. And it does really three things that align with what are called the triple aim. And the triple aim is really the holy grail in healthcare reform. In other words, can we simultaneously improve the quality of care we deliver, the experience of care that people feel, and can we make care more affordable? Mm. Oftentimes, we can impact two of those three. We can make the experience of care better and improve quality, but at great cost.
Ah.
Can we do both of the former items, but simultaneously lower cost? And palliative care does just that. So what I'd like to see is more widespread acceptance of palliative care across the entire delivery system. And one way to do that is to provide reimbursement that is sensical for people who are delivering care to people who live at home and can't go or won't go to the hospital, to provide ongoing assessment and management of chronic conditions so that people can live out their lives, accomplish their goals, and not be so dependent on cycling back through the hospital.
That ping-ponging you were describing.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, this just sounds so sensible to me. So what do you think what are the obstacles right now that this health reform is facing?
Well, like many things in medicine, it's like an ocean liner. And getting it to change or move is not easy. You have cultural issues around death and dying and end-of-life care, and that when you start mentioning terms like palliative care, there's a stigma associated with it because most people don't understand that palliative care is not necessarily end-of-life care. They've heard of it, but they've linked it with death and dying, and nobody wants to talk about death and dying. Most people would rather talk about the football game or their kids or what movie they saw this weekend. Death and dying is heavy. It's emotional. It's messy. So one of the things that has been a challenge is to remove stigma and to get the medical community and the lay public alike to think about palliative care, not as end-of-life care, but is meeting people's needs, matching treatments to patients' goals. And then at the same time, finding better ways to reimburse palliative care services and demonstrating that it actually saves costs, that it actually improves quality of care. It improves experience of care. It upholds that so-called triple aim that everybody's looking for in medicine and reform. So I would like to see palliative care scaled. It's being done in small iterative ways in pockets across the country, but nothing widespread, not yet.
So by scaled, you mean much more widespread. But right now, can you give me success stories or inspiring examples?
Yeah, absolutely. Some things that are happening around the country, you're seeing the slight emergence of at-home palliative care, although we're not exactly sure how to pay for that yet. You're finding that some insurance companies are saying, wait a minute, if we see providers and hospitals adopting palliative care, we might actually be able to improve outcomes and reduce costs, and that's very attractive. And there's one program in California doing just that. You're finding some folks in Massachusetts that are benefiting from at-home care, where they are receiving hospice-type care, but not necessarily in the throes of terminal illness, that are doing well. And some providers and hospitals are taking notice of this. So there are small things going on. We just haven't really developed any strong federal reimbursement systems or policies around how to grow palliative care in a more geometric way.
Mm. Do you think that families, I know I've heard horror stories than people with great regret when they look back over their options and realize they hadn't known about this option or hadn't taken it soon enough, I think is what I hear the most. I wish we'd stopped trying so hard and, you know, grandma wouldn't have been suffering so much if we had. Do you think that patients are starting to become more aware now that they do have these choices and are starting to ask for them? Is that another way this could change? In other words, you've described how the system has to change, but I'm wondering if there can be kind of a grassroots movement, or if more physicians are recognizing and adopting these practices even as best they can.
Right now, we're seeing palliative care becoming more mainstream only in the inpatient setting. You have somebody that is in the hospital already, and palliative care might be available because we figured out kind of a way to pay for palliative care in the acute hospital. What needs to happen is recognition that palliative care can exist at home outside of the hospital, where 99.9% of Americans live.
And want to be, as you say, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there are a number of people that are speaking and writing about these issues. One of the most famous newer works to come out is by an author named Atul Gawande, and he wrote a book called Being Mortal. And
I've read it. It changed my whole attitude toward my aging mother. And it's really, I think it's going to, don't you think it's having an effect, or has already?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Not only the book, but there's a series of video conferences that people are putting on based on the book that talk about ways to leverage some of the concepts that Dr. Gawande discusses in his book toward communities and what they can do to promote more palliative care. There are a number of other authors as well. Ira Byock is fairly famous, and he's written a number of books about dying well, about the most important things in life and how to ask for them. There's an author named Jessica Zitter, who is an intensive care physician in California, who her book was called Extreme Measures, and it dealt with how to advocate for your loved one when the hospital isn't answering everyone's questions appropriately. And then there are a few good websites out there that do talk about palliative care. One is called palliativedoctors.org, and that's from the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. The other one is called getpalliativecarealloneword.org, and that's from the Center to Advance Palliative Care, another organization that provides lots and lots of information for patients and their families about what exactly palliative care is, how to access it, and what it does.
So my sense is that it's up to us as potential patients and as potential family members to be thinking ahead realistically, even though it is difficult to think about this. This happens to all of us, right? To think ahead and become informed about the options that are available or can be available, but also be willing to talk to our doctors about our true choices. If they aren't asking us what do we value in life or what do we want, we need to be able to speak up and say, you know, what I care about is being at home with my family or being going to the casino or being able to garden, and be willing to express that rather than being passive in the face of just, well, do what you can do and hope for the best.
Exactly. But one of the best vehicles to help stream that conversation along is the advanced directive and to have a conversation about advanced care planning. So something I might recommend to listeners of this podcast is to consider, do you have an advanced directive? Should you have an advanced directive? And the answer is yes. And by bringing up the advanced directive, what it does is it codifies all of your wishes, all of your goals and values in terms of what if. What if something bad were to happen to me and I couldn't speak for myself? It's all written right here. So if you want to begin to have these conversations and you're not sure where to begin, ask yourself, do you have an advanced directive? Does it represent your wishes, your goals? Does your doctor or your hospital have a copy of this advanced directive? And does it take into account what you would want if you were ever seriously ill and couldn't speak for yourself? Mm-hmm. that alleviates the burden being placed on loved ones, family members, because too many times we see people coming in and no one knows what to do next, and there's no advance directive. Once an advance directive is in place, it speaks for that person and their goals and wishes, and it's a pretty direct but yet benign way to start opening up these bigger conversation issues about what to do and how to address the unthinkable. Because without the advance directive, then really unthinkable things start happening.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but thank you so much for being our guest. I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It to You, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the City of Public Radio Tulsa on the TU campus. We've been talking with Dr. Jeff Alderman about his research on improving end-of-life care. Please join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss in everyday language the nature and value of their research.